case of United States versus Matthews.
Mr. Elmer?
Good day, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Joshua Euler. I represent the appellant in this case, Juwan Matthews. Mr. Matthews asked the Court to vacate the sentencing in this matter and remand it for another sentencing hearing. The basis for that request, Your Honors, is that the sentencing that took place in this matter was fundamentally flawed, both in how the Court procedurally arrived at the sentence it imposed and then in imposing an unreasonable sentence of 78 months. I'd like to start my remarks this morning with how the Court procedurally erred, because the analysis really should stop there. There's no barometer in measuring how much weight is too much weight for a court to place on the guidelines when sentencing a defendant. And while I'm not suggesting that the Court adopt the old Supreme Court's old approach to obscenity, that is, you know it when you see it, as it applies to Mr. Matthews' case, I don't think that's a bad way of looking at it. In Gall versus United States, the Supreme Court said that it's a procedural error for the court to treat the guidelines as mandatory. I think as practitioners, sometimes we get caught up in pigeonholing things, and the briefs in this case sort of have the tone that a sentencing court can only treat the guidelines as either mandatory or advisory. That's obviously not the case. That hasn't been this court's approach. And as is the case with most things in life, it's not that black and white. There's a lot of gray area. The question is simply whether the court placed enough weight on the guidelines to afford them a presumption of reasonableness. And at the time the sentencing in this case was coming to a close, the government was clearly of the belief that the court had done just that. Otherwise, it would not have jumped in and asked the court to clarify or temper the remarks that it had made. Yet the government's likely to stand up here and suggest, as it has in its briefs, that the court's response to its own leading questions shows that the court, in this either advisory or mandatory framework, treated the guidelines as advisory. But obviously that wasn't the court's only comment on the guidelines and what role the guidelines not only played in the sentence, but in the what role the congressional intent behind the adoption of certain guidelines, specifically in this case the 18-to-1 ratio of the Fair Sentencing Act, played in the ultimate sentence. And each of the court's comments need to be looked at, not only in terms of what was said, but also when the court said them. And the court is said these things. Judge Randa said, in referencing the 18-to-1 ratio, we have to follow the law. And so the court is going to apply this 18-to-1 ratio. Later on in the hearing, Judge Randa said, referencing the 18-to-1 ratio, and I quote, it is something that the court is held to. Judge Randa went on to say that in order to achieve uniformity in sentencing, the court would have to achieve it by operating against the will and desire of the Congress. Mr. Matthews hasn't made these things up. I don't know how the government gets around these court's comments. Frankly, this is the tone that permeated the sentencing hearing. The approach the government has sort of taken thus far is to ignore the court's comments that ran through the sentencing hearing, instead of focusing on its acknowledgement at the very end of the hearing that the guidelines are, in fact, advisory.
Well, but by the time the court got around... really a problem for your argument here, though, isn't it?
Well, I don't think it is, Your Honor. And that's why I referenced United States versus Schmidt in my brief, because the district court judge in Schmidt repeatedly referenced, acknowledged that the guidelines were advisory, and then went on to impose a guideline sentence. But this court, in overturning or vacating the sentence in Schmidt, concluded that the district court judge placed too much weight on the guidelines. And that's why I sort of indicate that it's not a black and white issue. It's gray, and there's a lot of gray here. And it's sort of a balancing test. When you weigh the comments that permeated the sentencing hearing against the court's comments at the close of the sentencing hearing, and this is why I indicate that it's important to look at when the comments were made, because by the time Judge Randa acknowledged or responded to the government's leading question, the sentence had already been imposed. Supervised release had already been imposed. The restitution had been set. The only thing that hadn't taken place for the court to do was to advise Mr. Matthews of his appellate rights.
That doesn't diminish the force of the exchange. The prosecutor was double-backing on the comments that Judge Randa made early on in the sentencing colloquy to make it clear that the judge, to the extent that it needed to be made clear, we're, what, 6-7 years after Booker now, and everybody knows that the guidelines are advisory, but to the extent that the record needed to be clarified for any reason, the prosecutor was making that clear, that the judge was not disregarding his discretion, but merely stating his agreement with the regime that Congress had established.
And I don't dispute that the court knows the guidelines are advisory. I think the issue is the court's deference to the guidelines.
And the court is entitled to defer. Nothing in our case law, nothing post-Booker, suggests that the court is not entitled to defer to the guidelines. Quite the contrary. A guideline sentence is presumptively reasonable.
At the appellate level, it is.
Right. I understand that. But, you know, the court is entitled to defer to the sentencing commission and to the judgment of Congress about the ratio here, and is under no obligation to depart from that, even if colleagues down the hall are doing so.
Well, and I think that question or that issue sort of segues into one of into the reasonableness issue, but that wasn't the court's only procedural error that it made at sentencing hearing. And obviously the court addressed the crack cocaine disparity during the sentencing hearing. It was the central part of Mr. Matthews' argument. But the court failed to address the corollary of that argument, which was that applying a one-to-one ratio in this case was necessary to avoid an unwarranted sentencing disparity amongst similarly situated defendants. And the court, during the hearing, its statement of reasons never addressed the data that Mr. Matthews provided to the court regarding the, at that time it was 40 other defendants from the same community in Racine that had been prosecuted under the same gang task force operation.
And the average sentence, even on that data, is 70 months, over 70 months.
Correct.
And your client got 78 months.
He did.
So he's in range.
He's in range of the actual sentence, but when you look at the disparity or the difference between what these defendants' sentencing guideline ranges were, which were more than twice as much as Mr. Matthews, and the departures that those defendants received because of the application of a one-to-one ratio outweigh or are greater than the disparity between the two sentences.
Right. The problem with that argument is that it's a one-way ratchet, always down, right? I mean, if we were to accept this argument as an appellate matter, then the most lenient sentencing judge in town establishes the benchmark. That can't possibly be the law.
And I don't necessarily think it should be a district-wide practice.
That's the argument you're making.
But it's a more narrow focus, Your Honor, with regards to this relatively small community of Racine, which is, by my calculations, I believe the 24th smallest city in this circuit. And it was a concentrated approach to a relatively ununique problem, which is gang violence and drugs in the inner cities. But each of the other courts found that a one-to-one ratio was sufficient to accomplish the goals of Section 3553.
Right, and nothing about that binds any other judge. Every other judge is entitled to bring his or her own sentencing discretion to bear on the problem.
And I don't disagree with that, but
agree with the Sentencing Commission's 18-to-1.
In order, I think, for the court to make a decision on the reasonableness of the sentence, it would have to at least acknowledge and address the disparity argument under 3553A6, and the court in this case didn't do that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Jonathan Koenig, and I appear on behalf of the United States. We're asking you to affirm the within-guideline sentence in this case, and because the panel has anticipated a lot of the points that I was going to make this morning, I will be brief. First of all, on the Schmidt case, which goes to the alleged procedural error here, I remember the Schmidt case well because it came from our district and from a sentencing judge who used a lot of words suggesting that he felt constrained or compelled to follow the guidelines. That was one of the problems, and not all of those references were cited in the Schmidt opinion, but there were quite a few of them. That was one of the problems in Schmidt. Another problem that the court had there was the sentencing judge's apparent belief or the fact that the sentencing judge may have given the impression that child pornography cases are different somehow. And, of course, as I note in my brief, Schmidt was fairly early in our collective experience with Booker. It was 06 or 07. And so in light of the uncertainty about whether the judge considered the guidelines advisory or not, it made sense to send the case back. I don't think that's true here by any stretch. And so I'd like to move on to the reasonableness part of the argument. If I understand Mr. Euler, he basically wants you to send this back to Judge Randa and compel him to apply the one-to-one ratio. I don't know how you do that without saying it's unreasonable to follow 18-1. After Kimbrough, judges
have a lot
of... I suppose
the only way you do it is to say, send it back and say, be more reasonable, and keep it undefined.
That's problematic, too, Your Honor, because as the court's opinions make clear...
The whole issue is problematic at sentencing. It's not an art. It's a real problem, no matter where you sit on the thing. So.
Indeed, and the point I was just going to make is that, you know, if Kimbrough gives a certain judge the freedom to decide that a particular guideline is too harsh, that's fine, but it also gives Judge Randa the freedom... Judge Randa is a judge for whom deference to the legislature is that's an important part of his judicial philosophy. Kimbrough gives him the freedom to incorporate that into his sentencing rationale.
Well, considering Congress hasn't given him a pay raise in a long time, I don't know why his deference is so strong, but there you are.
He's very old school.
So I don't have much more to say except that I think the I'm not sure how you craft the opinion that my opponent, Mr. Euler, is asking you to issue without flying in the face of Kimbrough, the presumption of reasonableness, the congressional determination of 18-1, and, of course, the other 3553A factors, which I've discussed in my brief. So if there are no further questions, I would ask you to approve.
Thank you. You can have the whole minute, Mr.
I don't have much more to add, but for commenting that the reasonableness analysis is not focused on the guidelines, obviously. And
what would you say to the judge if you sent it back?
Pardon me?
What would you say to the judge if you were the one drafting the order sending it back, what would you say?
I would ask that the court
be more reasonable. Yeah.
Well, that the court insert Circuit Rule 36 and send it to a different court.
So your solution is not to tell them how to handle the sentencing, but just to tell them don't sentence it; somebody else will do it for you.
Well, there was this testimony of this Racine police detective Dan Langendorf at the sentencing hearing that I think sort of served as a message to the court that the government sort of meant business. I'd never seen anything like that in a sense.
Yeah, I've been listening to it for years and years and years. The government tells the judge that this is a very important and significant case to tell the same thing to juries. And judges either accept it or they don't. I'm trying to figure out what do you tell the judge that he doesn't already know about the existence and the status of the law.
Well, I'd ask the judge to actually consider the argument that...
I take it you were appointed to this court.
I was appointed in the trial court, too.
Did you make that argument to Judge Rand?
I did in a sentencing memorandum that was relatively detailed that the court didn't address.
Okay. You lost. We'll see. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And Mr. Euler, as Judge Bauer just mentioned, you were appointed.